Progressive News Network, a new Mercury Media production, where you'll find the voices of activists, the voices of those working to make this a better world. We believe that as we face challenging times, the human spirit can face and surmount the foolish and the short-sighted. Tune in every Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, for the live show, or anytime you can. Progressive News Network, found at www.newmercurymedia.com/PNN/. We have a future. Tune in and build it with us. Underwritten by Florida Media Labs, produced by Rick Spivak in cooperation with Canary and a Coal Mine Films. Progressive News Network.
Here we are at Inaugural Central for our inaugural special. Hey, Brooke, how you doing? Brooke, can you hear me? Hello, Brooke. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Brookster, can you hear me? Well, let's see. I guess, Brooke, are you in? Let me turn you off and turn you back on. Brookster, can you hear me? Yes, yes, I hear you.
I can hear you. Super.
Okay, fantastic.
I've watched quite a few inaugural processions, and I wasn't going to watch this one, not for any other reason than the fact that I was busy this afternoon and out seeing clients and getting some work done. And so just turned on television a while ago. And I got to say, this seems to me to be quite a solemn, downbeat, kind of morose visage that I'm witnessing here. It's a cloudy day. It's a gray day. It doesn't look to me to be a very energized or animated crowd. I remember one of the very first inaugurations, or one of the first processions that I ever watched as a kid, was Jimmy Carter. And a lot of people remember that was notable for when they came up on Pennsylvania Avenue. He insisted on walking the rest of the way to be with the people, you know, to get out of the limousine and walk the rest of the way. And, you know, nothing could be further from that moment than this moment. There's bulletproof Cadillac. There's all of the Secret Service. There's just flanks of what looks to be security and military, and there looks to be more security and military in some places than onlookers. It's a very gray, drizzly, downbeat kind of day. What's your sense as you're watching this?
Well, of course, there's already been riots. And, you know, we were all told several times that, you know, the rowdy people broke some windows, and allegedly there are stories about policemen being hurt. We did hear the charming sound of flashbangs and witnessed what looked to be tear gas. So it is a typical American celebration. The seamless transfer of power from a thinking, educated man to a buffoon. And it's a really special kind of thing. I mentioned that one of the things that this show is going to talk a little bit about is some of the interesting furniture that the Trumpster has invited to Washington with him. Referring to people like Ms. DeVos, who, while she's not really sure if handicapped people should be educated, she does know, however, that grizzly bears are a danger to school children, so therefore our schools need to be armed. I'm just wondering, you know, if she knows about Venusians, and we may need flamethrowers too, but that's another story. You know, I thought that the story of Mr. Mnuchin, who the banker who assured us again and again that there is there are plenty of incentives for bankers to go any route except foreclosure. And yet, you know, he did foreclose on some little old ladies for less than a couple hundred bucks. So there is that, you know, should we say, internal dialogue, if you want to put it that way. Another standout, I thought, was the gentleman who would legislate, then buy stock. And now he assured us that it was a coincidence that the person who handles investments would invest in the things that he happened to be legislating on. It was entirely all above board and done according to law. So if you want to change it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course,
mm-hmm.
the old Republican refrain of, you know, this is law and order. We're for law and to the letter of the law, which, of course, leaves one plenty of wiggle room if you're writing the laws, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a standout among the... Go ahead.
I absolutely do. You know, a former governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who has been nominated to head the Department of Energy.
Replacing a physicist, might I add.
Yes, and a physicist, and before him, a Nobel Prize winner. And, you know, the Department of Energy was one of the departments, the three departments, one that he couldn't remember, you know,
right,
that he wanted
right.
to cut during one of the primary debates in one of the last cycles. And he didn't even know when he was nominated for this position what the Department of Energy actually does. He thought that what he would be doing was being some sort of ambassador to oil companies and energy companies, and much to his surprise, the Department of Energy does things having to do with nuclear weapons and you know, things of that nature, and has absolutely nothing to do with going and visiting Saudi oil sheikhs and things of that nature.
Right, Mr. Tillerson probably could have helped him with that if he really needed to.
Right.
State Department, the ambassador from Exxon, you know. And, it's one after another. Pruitt, I don't know if you caught any of the testimony that Mr. Pruitt gave. Pruitt is going to be at the EPA. He was asked, I thought, to great effect by the former comedian senator, well, why was it that you placed all these suits against the EPA? He said, well, it was very simple. He was protecting a constituency. He was doing what he was supposed to do. He was defending a constituency. And they said, well, then why is this? Why did you use their letter? I mean, you literally just put your letterhead over top of a letter from the oil industry to defend fracking, to defend the earthquakes where, you know, of course, Oklahoma now has more earthquakes than California. And he said, well, it was simply doing his job defending his state. And they said, well, let me ask you this. You know, if you're looking after your state so effectively and so well, what have you done for, you know, the actual people, you know, the people of Oklahoma? And I think that sort of threw him. He really wasn't
prepared
for the question.
Yeah, the people of Oklahoma who have been experiencing earthquakes because of fracking in a place that historically had pretty much been earthquake-free, had not been an earthquake zone. What have you been
well,
doing for these guys? And
he ultimately did come up with a snappy answer. He said because he had no standing to protect the people. You see, he was there simply to protect the corporations. You know, I mean, an attorney general's job certainly has nothing to do with people. I mean, my God.
Wow.
Imagine that.
Wow, that is so radical. That is incredibly radical. So he prefaced his entire defense on I was representing the people I was supposed to represent, and then come to find out that the only people that he is equipped to represent are corporations, and that people don't figure into that equation at all.
Well, you know, Brooke, you live in the center part of the state, And we, those of us over on the coast, you know, call that the flyover part of Florida. Since
right.
you represent the good center, let me ask mm-hmm. you this: you know, when they put Linda McMahon from the Wrestling Federation in charge of the Small Business Administration, do you think this is going to lead us to trial by combat? I mean, what do you think that she's going to bring to the Small Business Administration?
Oh my! You know,
flashy new costumes.
a cage fighter in
there you go.
On
there you go.
On every on every block. You know, I think there's a lot of people who are just hoping that not a lot of anything happens for the next 4 years. I was listening to
Yeah,
I was listening to Matt Taibbi on a Sam Cedar's show a little while ago, and he was reminding listeners of how little work that Ronald Reagan actually did while he was in office, and he only worked a couple hours a day, and he had his aides create videos because it was too difficult for him to. Read briefing papers, so they had to be broken down for him into pictures that moved, and preferably animated. And he'd break off at, like, you know, after lunch because he got tired and things like that. And we found out later that he was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, there's some explanation in that. And so, you know, I keep cautioning people that when you think about the Trump administration, try not to focus too hard on Trump. Think back to the Reagan administration when H.W. Bush was doing most of the heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. H.W. Bush was, of course, you know, the former director of the CIA, and
right.
you know, really what was
this,
going on.
That State Department
that
adjunct
was,
down in the basement.
Exactly. And what was notable during those administrations, during that time, was Iran-Contra and a lot of craziness in the Middle East that set us up for what is going on now. But nobody paid attention to that because it was happening through the vice president's office, and everybody spent all of their time on this colorful, bizarre figure head who was the president, you know, Ronnie Reagan. And, you know, with his bad memory and his colorful nature, and nobody paid any attention to the guy behind the curtain. The guy behind the curtain in this administration is Pence, and this guy Pence is truly terrifying. You know, he's a Christian dominionist. He knows how to. He knows his way around working the levers of Congress. He's not a complete outsider. People have come to the aid of folks within the Pence part of the administration to bring people on who will get things done. I think that it's crucial that people don't get too wrapped up in the Donald Trump facade, because that's all it is. It's a facade. They're not going to let him near the big box of crayons. You know, there's going to be other people who are running things, and they're not going to, you know, really let him, you know, run loose with too much stuff.
Well, I think you're making a very, very good point. And with this bunch of hoodlums that he's got with him, his crew, if you will, you know, even if the Trumpster makes a short day of it, that does not mean that his minions won't be out there doing the evil work that must be done. I think that Donnie and the boys were listening to you, because he's now walking part of the parade route, so that he can take up the cudgel with at least as much aplomb as Brother Jimmy did.
right.
You know, another thing I wanted to mention, and I think it's certainly worth considering, is, you know, we heard a very, very strident, almost a campaign-style inaugural. None of this bury the hatchet, let's all work together stuff. But he basically said over and over and over again that, you know, it's a good thing that we threw these rascals out, that now the government is in your hands. You're the people. You're the ones in charge. And we did this for you, and now you're the ones who are going to reap the benefits, because it's all been the rich guys who benefited all along. And, you know, you have to wonder if there wasn't kind of the spirit of the French Revolution paranoia among the hoi polloi up there with him on the dais, because it was them they were talking about. And I think that the discussions of this inaugural speech are gonna echo for a while, because it was, I would say, stridently populist. And the good people at CNN chimed in with, they thought it was a, quote, radical speech.
Mm-hmm.
So if
mm-hmm.
CNN was prepared to call it radical with their credentials on the line, so to speak, I think that it's really one for the books. And I think that, you know, those of us who care about the Republic are in for a steamy read tonight, you know?
Yeah. I can't wait to read it, actually. I didn't have much interest in consuming much of the ceremony with regards to the inauguration, and it really wasn't any kind of conscious boycott on my part. It's just I'm swamped with work and I don't have a lot of time to keep the TV on, because I will get sucked into it and find myself angry and not working.
Well, I will admit that while I have had it on and some of the analysis through most of the day, when it came time for the actual acceptance speech, I had to step away. And it was not that I have a delicate stomach, but one can only take so much baloney.
Right.
At one time.
Right.
So I did not hear it. And I turned the radio back on in time to hear, except me. And I thought, oh my God. And then a voice of some arch conservative said, and let me be the first to announce Mr. President Donald J. Trump. And I thought, oh my God, it's the old shadow over the graveyard once again, you know. It's a pretty sobering thing. I just hope that tomorrow the protests aren't victimized by agent provocateurs. It's my biggest concern, frankly.
Yeah, right. You know what?
Go ahead.
Well, there's no doubt that what we're observing right now is historic. No one like Donald Trump has taken office within our historic period. It's not outside the realm of possibility that, you know, earlier in this country's history there were, you know, that there were characters like this that we have kind of glossed over, and we don't quite talk of them in the same manner. That's kind of my suspicion about some of our earlier leaders. I'm probably being far too generous to Donald Trump on that. But this is historic, and I think that one of the reasons that it's historic is because of how weak it shows the opposition party to be right now in 2017.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the Republicans, led by this, you know, extreme character who has, you know, this is a person, Donald Trump, who is an extreme character who, you know, came into office mixing teeny tiny bits of truth with embellished with all kinds of crazy lies, and appealed to people throughout the country who were experiencing some of the worst economic distress that exists in the country, and he was able to make that appeal to those people because the Democratic Party, the opposition, has abandoned those people. All right, so like we've in our analysis, there's a great piece in 538 yesterday or the day before, where one of the writers was talking about how we've confused economic anxiety with economic hardship, and when you look at the people who voted for who actually voted for Trump, you see a lot of people with middle class demographics. You see a lot of people who live in the heartland. Well, people who live in the heartland have economic anxieties because their jobs are moving away, coming back. So you put them in the economic anxiety column rather than the economic hardship column. And then those who are middle class, working class, middle class, working middle class, or a little bit to the upper edge of middle class, transactional middle class, people who are brokers, like real estate brokers and accountants, people who rely on transactions to make their living, some forms of few people who do some kinds of law, transactionalists, they're always feeling economic anxiety because whenever the economy turns down, transactions are the first to go away. So those folks who are living in heartland areas are feeling economic anxiety at a time when everybody else is feeling economic anxiety. So on a demographic sheet, they're going to look like they're not experiencing economic hardship because they've got income, but it doesn't mean that they're not experiencing economic anxiety. They have plenty of economic anxiety. There was a writer in the 80s who wrote a book, his name was Paul Fussell, wrote a book called Class, and he talked about how the middle class has the most anxieties of all the classes. People in lower classes don't have as much aspirational anxiety, and people in upper classes feel like they've already made it. Well, in the middle classes, are always trying to hold on and cling to what they have, and they always feel like someone's going to come along and take away what they got. So that's where anxiety comes from. And that's people who voted for Trump.
Well, it's going to be interesting, that's for sure. I've held to the hope that with these greedy people at each other's throats, will be safer than we might otherwise see, simply because they'll be fighting among themselves so much. But when you look at that cast of characters that he's bringing to D.C. to help implement Trumpeterianism, it's pretty sobering stuff. And I have to admit that it's going to take everything that the progressives have to withstand this, you know, full frontal across the board assault. You know, when I hear that they plan to shut down the NEA and NPR, you know, I got to say, let us hope that those of us who believe in the value of the arts and humanities have the wherewithal to stand up. And unfortunately, I have my doubts, you know?
Right. Right. Well, and with good cause, because at the same time you've got all of that going on in Trumpistan, you've got the third way, announcing that they're launching a $20 million project to lift up their kind of politics and messaging. And if anybody wants to learn anything about the Third Way, just, you know, get online, Google the Third Way. It's basically the Blue Dog and New Democrat strategy that gave us, you know, the end of welfare and the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And a lot of people, myself included, believe that the third way politics is what has landed us in the position that we are now, which is in out in the wilderness. So they're spending $20 million to dig the hole deeper. And David Brock, who is known for funding a giant troll operation during the primaries to make sure that the Sanders coalition was good and alienated from the Democratic Party and would have no way to integrate back in after the primaries were over. He's come back, and he's in Palm Beach this weekend with the Florida Alliance and Democracy Alliance folks, asking for money to do his next big thing, which I guess is more hippie punching. You know, it'll be like hippie punching on steroids. Yeah. So you've got these two organizations, and that's just two. There's plenty more where that came from, that are in position to double down and triple down on the failed policies of the past, on the failed strategies of the past, and the failed tactics of the past. And you know, for those of us out here who, you know, look at what's getting ready to happen, like shutting down NPR and shutting down public television and shutting down the National Endowment for the Arts, things like that, none of this third way David Brock business is aimed at that. It's aimed at shutting down progressive voices at a time when you need progressive voices in order to keep that part of our culture alive, because we're the people who have been the standard bearers for, you know, progressive culture since the very beginning.
That's right. It wasn't the conservatives that stood up for women's rights or African American rights or Indian rights. They weren't the ones that fought the battles for weekends, vacations, end of child labor, none of that stuff. And, you know, they think they can do without us. I think we can do without them.
Well, it's going to end up that way, and it's kind of ended up that way because the way that Brock ran the trolling operation during the primaries alienated so many of the Sanders voters that it didn't leave them any room to come back in and reintegrate into the party. And
right.
Even people who did want to come back in and reintegrate have had to face attacks every day, you know, where, you know, any kind of talk of accountability is met with, oh, you're just a Putin lover, or, you know, you're all for Trump. It's we're at this point where you can't have reasonable, sensible adult discourse. It's all just name calling. And, you know, here's the thing. When a lawmaker like Cory Booker casts a vote against piece of legislation as reasonable as importing lower cost medicines from Canada, and he's one of the senators who takes the most money from pharma, then it's absolutely appropriate to call him out and hold him accountable for that vote. And the pushback that has been generated out of that has all been generated in the language of David Brock's, you know, trolling operation. Oh, it's the Bernie bros, and they're going to be the death of the party, and you know, we have to get rid of them before they, you know, put the last, bullet in the Democratic Party and blah, 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 and all this. And, you know, it's just a bunch of hogwash, and it's just it's really bad strategy, and I hate to see it happen. It's really tragic.
Yep. Well, my dear, thank you so much for joining me. I have an interview with Professor Wendy Lynn Lee to play next, and it's pretty pungent stuff, so I urge you to stick around. Thanks again so much,
all right,
Brooke. We'll talk to you Sunday, okay?
Okay, super. See you then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, so here we go. We've got Professor Wendy Lynn Lee with her thoughts on the Trump administration and the cabinet and inaugural.
Good morning.
Good morning, Professor. How are you today?
I am, to be perfectly frank with you, every few minutes near tears today.
Of course, I'm looking forward to discussing some of the bright spots in the Trump nominee selection as we prepare
okay.
for what might be a...
By bright, I assume you mean less dismally dark.
No, not necessarily. Names
okay.
Tillerson of Exxon, Munchen, mortgage proprietor
oh,
right. chains,
oh, so,
Mad Dog.
So you're making a sick joke is what you're doing.
Well, you know, the powerless have satire. We may not have much else, but we have satire.
Oh, I still have my voice. I may not be in the streets today, but I still have my voice, and I've now completely papered over my office window at school with the refuse Trump with the anti-fascism posters. There's no light that comes into the window of my office window at my at school now.
Is this some kind of metaphor of the vision of the Trump administration, sort of no light, no see, I see nothing.
Descending darkness.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
it's a metaphor for. I was just saying to my partner Kevin that for my whole life, and I'm 57 now, I have held on to this hope, sometimes a sicker reed, sometimes a thinner one, this kind of dream for my country, and I feel like I will never see the recovery of my country after this catastrophe that's beginning today. I won't live to see. It'll recover eventually in some sense, some way, but I won't live to see that because this catastrophe is so profound.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, you put it in that perspective because literally that's the direction I wanted to head first before we get into the... the bright lights of the Trump administration. I wanted to ask you, I want you to look back to your childhood, to your youth, and
mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, when did you first sort of become aware of national policy issues, of presidents and stuff like that? Is this Nixon? Is it earlier? My own memories go back to the very tail end of the Eisenhower administration, but
mm-hmm.
you know, when did you kind of become aware that national policy goes beyond the mythology that we learned in grade school?
As a little girl in the 1960s, listening to my dad and my much older sister Ginger, she's 10 years older than I am, I listened to them argue, sometimes pretty heatedly, at the dinner table over the Vietnam War. That was the birth of my political conscience. Plus, I grew up in the West, in Colorado Springs, Manitou Springs, and much of my political conscience was formed by many of the issues that confronted Native Americans. So I was the kid who was trying to raise money to free Leonard Peltier. I was that kid. I was the kid whose family adopted a Native American child, and so had some, at least a semblance, I think a shallow one at that time, but a semblance of what the importance of those issues were that I have a deeper understanding of now. But if there was any one single salient thing, it was my opposition to the Vietnam War and my father's racism in the course of it.
Wow. Wow. I recall those days well. And you know, the interesting thing is, while most of American politics learned, I would argue almost nothing about the mistakes of the Vietnam War, certainly you cannot fault the military that they have totally sanitized the future wars. Body counts, the night footage just does not exist anymore. And they call it embedded, but there's probably a more pungent term for basically the gutting and the gentrification of the coverage.
That's a good way to put it, the gentrification of war coverage. I talk to my students about that when I teach this course in war and terrorism and torture, and I explain to them, because they're so much younger, you know, they don't know what it was to watch the nightly body bag count with Walter Cronkite. But I remember vividly because my dad thought Walter Cronkite was a communist, right? Not that my dad really understood what a communist was. He just associated that with Soviet Russia. But he thought Cronkite a communist because Cronkite read to us the body bag count, because we knew what the death toll was in Vietnam. And my father knew that that turned particularly lots of young people like my older sister, Jen, against the war.
Well, you know, that's how they used to peg efficacy. But now I think it's just checks from Congress. We don't see any of that stuff. The reason I wanted to say that was because, you know, we, those of us who pay attention to these matters, and I count myself one of those, I started keeping track of American politics on a very, very rigorous basis during the Nixon administration, because I thought back then what I was seeing was so preposterous, was so outlandish, was so beyond anything that I had ever heard described in the American political system, that I thought unless this was documented by a disinterested third party like myself, there was just no way people would believe what we were seeing, what we were hearing. I mean, here, this guy, you know, was elected while there was a huge investigation about him literally subverting the Constitution. I couldn't believe it. I thought that this was so far outside the American experience. Little did I know.
But look how tepid that all appears now. You know, when I think back on Watergate, and I was that child who actually watched the Watergate hearings for one entire summer that I remember pretty vividly. I'd like come in from riding my bicycle to watch the Watergate hearings. And I reflect back on that now, and the break-ins and the thefts and this, the dirtiness of it. I still think, in comparison, not to just what's coming, but what we already have, the egregious conflicts of interest, right? A man who effectively rapes veterans on their mortgages, right? A guy, Pruitt, who's going to gut the Environmental Protection Agency, right? A president who's going to turn our energy independence into a wasteland of oil and gas production. I think, wow, Nixon, you know, if given the choice between, say, Nixon, even as dead, and Donald Trump, I'd still, if those are the only two options, man, I'd still pick Nixon.
Sure.
If these are my, Reagan, right? Reagan looks less like an Alzheimer's victim to me right now. Right. George W. Bush actually seems relatively sane and intelligent by comparison, because what we have coming into office is a classless cretin.
It's hard to view sometimes. You know, it's kind of like that accident that you want to look away from. Your eye keeps being drawn back. Because you're an educator, I'm going to start with the illustrious and esteemed Miss DeVos. Well, she may not be sure that handicapped children deserve education. She is enthusiastic about guns because, of course, grizzly bears.
Right. That's right. We have to protect children from the grizzly bears, Rick. That's very important. Because we have grizzly bears who come into the schools to eat the children.
The other thing that I thought was so incredible, you know, I like yourself, I'm an enthusiast of C-SPAN. I once dragged my family home from a vacation so we could record Ollie North and Von Hall. So I'm right there with you. You know, here we have a person who is enthusiastic in her support for commercial education, who, oddly enough, owns a company that pursues student debt. Now, that particular, you know, lock and key sort of mentality, you know, I mean, you think that that would be laughed out of the public square in some
way. But you'd think that Price's investment in a biotech company would simply rule him out for Health and Human Services, too. It seems to me that these are of a he's a legislator. Yeah, I mean, I take these to be of a piece, but what we're going to find out, I think, is whether or not Trump is correct when he says that his supporters simply don't care, right? He keeps insisting that his supporters, that his base, doesn't care about these egregious profiteering conflicts of interest. Maybe they don't care until they can't get insurance anymore. Maybe they don't care when the only school that their kid gets to go to is the public school that's been gutted of funding. Maybe that's when they start to care. I don't know. But that's, I think, what we'll find out is whether they care and how soon.
Well, you know, it's just amazing to me. I mean, each one is worse than the next one. You know, we've got this guy Mnuchin who will sit here and say to a congressman, we are so incentivized to not foreclose, and yet the stories are there. He foreclosed on people who owe, you know, less than $100. People thrown out of their homes. You know,
elderly women.
Yeah.
Veterans, what is wrong with it? He was a foreclosure machine, right, as I saw in an editorial somewhere yesterday, and clearly has no remorse about it, and it doesn't matter what he says, because the facts are the facts.
And, you know, whether you think about a Rick Perry, who thought so much of the EPA that he couldn't remember it, and now he's going to lead it. It's really interesting. And of course, you know, the Republicans stack these hearings back to back, so that even we C-SPAN enthusiasts really can't watch all of them. We just
that's the whole point, right? Is to make sure that the public just can't keep up, so he can ramrod them through. Right, and then begin his first 100 days of gutting the country.
It's a sobering time for sure. You know, under normal circumstances, we might say Jeff Sessions, unacceptable as a judge, now may very well end up as Attorney General.
That turns my stomach. I just have to say that out loud. That prospect simply turns my stomach.
Here we have a fellow whose real problem with the Ku Klux Klan was that they smoked pot. Now, that's a special guy. Certainly.
Yeah, and you know, and that comment is the least of it, right? When you look at his record, there is a clearly established pattern of racial discrimination in that record, of racial harassment in that record. And this is a man who strongly supports voter ID that we all know ensures that elderly people, poor people, and African-American people and Hispanic people don't vote. We all know it. That is the point of voter ID, is to exclude people from the vote in order to ensure that the Republican Party stays in power. And that, at least for me, is one of one of the most important things that makes Jeff Sessions wholly and utterly unfit to be Attorney General.
Which brings us to Scott Pruitt.
Yeah.
Scott Pruitt, who had standing, oddly enough. I was really attentive to his testimony because I thought it was intriguing, and so did one or two Democrats there, that here on the one hand he's launched all these suits opposing EPA action on behalf of the oil industry, who literally ghost wrote most of his complaints, which is, you know, kind of interesting.
Yeah. But not unusual.
Yeah. He explained, though, that he really couldn't defend or protect the actual citizens because he had, I guess as the term of art is, he had no standing to protect the citizens of Oklahoma, despite the incredible...
Yeah, I find that a lame excuse.
...rise of fracking-related problems. You know, you're a person who's literally, you know, gone the extra mile to protect the environment, to protect water resources especially. You know, are they just going to turn off the lights, do you think? Or are they going to, you know, grant oil companies, obviously new leases and, you know, public parks and all that. But you know, what's your thinking, you know? What's their plan?
I think the plan is pretty clear. They've made these enormous inflated promises about jobs. And of course, one thing that we know about the oil and gas industry is that it is not actually a tremendous job creator, right? But they made these inflated promises about jobs, about American energy independence. And they're going to do everything they can to make good on those promises in order to ensure that Trump is reelected in 2020. So what they have to do in order to make good on those promises is sell out in toto and on day one, which is what Trump has promised, that he's going to lift regulations on, for example, the construction of Keystone on day one, which is tomorrow or Monday at the latest. Right, so to make good on these promises, they're going to despoil, gut, pollute, destroy the environment. We're going to become the country that completely fouls its own nest in order to ensure a few jobs and the immense wealth of the immensely wealthy.
Well, with the termination, I think, is probably inevitable of minimum wage. You know, I had someone say to me today that, they thought that, Main Street is really the bulwark now, that it'll have to be Main Street because we can't count on anybody else to stand up for us. And I said, you know, I really thought that was putting your your eggs literally in the mouth of the opossum. Because I think that Main Street's going to celebrate this guy, that, you know, taking off the regulations, allowing them to pollute, allowing them to, you know, kill any kind of social service net. You know, this is not where our allies come from. I am, however, hoping that the progressive side of the universe finally pulls together, although there's no historical... or at least very little historical evidence for that. One other person I wanted to talk about, because I am and have been for a long time a peace activist, the General Mattis, the butcher of Fallujah, protected the mercenaries by destroying an entire city. And of course, the mostly untold story about the hardened weapons, the depleted uranium weapons, which is going to be those areas for hundreds of years. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, and in some ways for forever, right? They won't ever be. Yeah. But the uptick, I think, that we are likely to see in American militarism following the machismo of his defense team and the machismo of Trump's own boundless ego and where that money is going to come from, right? This was a president who wanted, I was reading yesterday, in his parade, wanted to have missile launchers and tanks, right, so that the parade would resemble a bit more either a Russian or a North Korean celebration of a presidency of an elected official. And it seems to me that that speaks volumes about the kind of country, what he sees America as, right? And not as a country, but as two things, an exploitable commercial opportunity, a new brand, America Inc., it's a new brand, and as a fortress of militarism. And when you combine all of that with the staggering ignorance of this president and many on his team, just the staggering ignorance, it seems to me that our relationships with Russia, but and even, I think, ultimately, more importantly, with China, right, who really has the power, are going to simply deteriorate, and the big winner at the end of the day is going to be China.
I heard the comment from that Chinese millionaire, Mr. Ma, that it's not about stealing jobs. It's about the fact that you guys have invested in militarism. And I'm really willing to bet that he didn't search that out on Google. It is probably true. And you see that best reflection from someone outside your ballpark when looking back at America, he sees this militaristic state who's prepared to insist on their will around the world. And evidently, the idea that we are not the world's policemen has dawned on everybody else except us.
Yeah. And of course, think about it just in a really ordinary moral, from any ordinary morally principled way, the notion that any nation state should be the world police is obscene. It's just an obscenity. What? Why does the world require a single superpower, or even a competition of superpowers? That, I mean, I know that you and I grew up in a world where that was sort of just an is what it is, the world of the competing superpowers, the posturing militarism. But there's nothing that requires that, and there's much to argue against it, particularly the increase in nuclear stockpiles, which I think we're now going to see, right? Despite Trump's rhetoric to the contrary, it only makes us that much more vulnerable, right? I mean, nuclear war will get us if climate change doesn't get us first. And there's just so much of it, you know? I mean, just honestly keeping track from every angle. I mean, what's going to happen with respect to reproductive rights? What's going to happen with respect to gay rights? What's going to happen with respect to the environment? What's going to happen with respect to protections for endangered species? I mean, there is no avenue from which we can approach this that there's not potentially impending disaster.
Here we have Senator Bernie Sanders. Say what you will, flawed or not, the man's in the fight. Like nobody.
Yes.
And here
agreed.
Got Republicans to sign on to a bill to cut drug prices, which every thinking person who's not in the drug industry thinks are unconscionable.
Yes, and of course they are.
The question I have to ask you, sir, my dear, is where is what might laughably call Democratic leadership when 13 Democrats go over to the Republican side and Ted Cruz and one other of those loons signs up with Bernie? I'm afraid that I cannot say that there is any Democratic leadership. Now, I understand some apologists said to me, oh, well, Rick, you know, Nancy was out sick. She was having, you know, medical issues. Okay, she has no staff. This didn't come full-born in an afternoon. This had to be discussed, debated. It was not a new issue. How? And then Schumer. Well.
Yeah. I don't have a lot nice to say about Schumer.
You know, if there is no leadership to be found, if you can have Republicans signing on to a bill to help working people with their drug costs. You can't get Democrats to sign up for that. Then you have to.
I simply read this as straightforwardly symptomatic of a party in complete disarray without leadership. I have long been very critical of the Democrats for both being Republicans, for being spineless. Whether or not we're going to see any real leadership in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, I don't know. Well, I guess I gotta hope so, but I'm not holding my breath, and I just found that to be, just one more insult on top of insult, and I'm endlessly disappointed in the Democrats. I'm not one. That's not a party I'm going to be joining.
Well, we just had a slate of candidates run for leadership in the Democratic Party, and for the sake of our democracy, I played and hosted interviews with the five candidates. But I think you'll be happy to know that the richest one won, who basically made no bones about the fact that, if nothing else, he's rich. And I thought, we have certainly learned the qualification for our age. If nothing else, he's at least rich.
Well, and I guess that actually offers an excellent segue to my closing comment that I thought actually
hit
him on. Oh, not yet? Okay.
I was saving one topic for the end myself.
Oh, that's totally fine. Okay. Go right ahead.
I just, basically to keep track on what the official lie is, I will watch mainstream news. I was watching the MSNBC propaganda show, and I heard I heard Ron Paul make what is probably the argument for future days. He said, and I paraphrase, it makes no sense to give life insurance to the dead, and it makes no sense to give health insurance to someone with a pre-existing condition. And I thought, Now there's the counter argument. There's the argument that says, in its fine Darwinian flavor, if they're sick, they're obviously unfit.
Yeah. What is there to be said in response to that? I can reiterate that he's plainly conscienceless. Remarks like that leave me increasingly speechless. It's like I often now feel like I can scream, but I don't even have the words to really articulate how vacuous and vile I think that position is. But, what we're going to see and soon, and it's going to affect gazillions of us, not just the people who say can't get health care or say folks like my mom who's, on Medicare. But all of us who then have to make up the difference, right, which is millions and millions of us, right? Whatever happens to my mom's Medicare, I make up the difference, which means I work many more years. And surely this cannot be good for the health of anyone, no matter who they are. So among the greatest disasters, I think, about to befall us is the end of the Affordable Care Act and the possibility, and the Republicans seem to keep wanting to deny it, but clearly what's going to happen, that people are going to not be able to get health insurance. Right? This means that people who have health insurance but are in an employment, say, that is, say, harassing, a woman who's being sexually harassed by her boss, wants to quit, wants to go someplace else. Maybe she's got diabetes. She can't quit. She's just going to have to suck that up because she won't be able to get health insurance. Or the family who has the child who now has to rely on, say, St. Jude, great institution. But as actually my partner, as Kevin pointed out to me the other night, he said, how could it be that we live in a country where hospitals have to beg for money you know, have to use their own sick children in images on television commercials to beg for money in order to be able to treat children with leukemia. What kind of country is it that requires that? Right, that where parents can't just assume their child will be treated. Right? That's a country that is not merely without conscience, but without heart. And that is what we have in the White House. No conscience and no heart.
Aside from the fact that this fellow is supposed to be some kind of physician, I always thought that one of the basic humane values of civilization was that every life had worth. And that curious philosophical phrase, "we are our brother's keeper," wasn't just for Sunday afternoon. Theoretically, what separates us from other societies, and of course, biological studies have shown that altruism starts way, way down the evolutionary chain, but evidently seems to have skipped Republicans for whatever reason. My dear, I got it.
I'm not sure it didn't just skip human beings.
Well, I know some that are fine practitioners of humane value,
mm-hmm.
myself and many of
sure.
my personal
and you. And these are the people over the next some years that I'm going to be counting on and looking to as I work with others to foment every bit of resistance that I can from where I am.
Well, since I'm ready to let you go back to the good work that you do as an educator and so many other things, human being, I'm going to say you had some parting thoughts you wanted to...
I just have one brief observation that I felt I was watching I was watching Trump at his first ball last night, just for a few minutes until I just started to feel dirty even watching it. And I thought there was this moment that just epitomized a great deal, just sort of epitomized everything that he is, the genuine troglodyte Neanderthal that he is. When he asked Kellyanne Conway to come up on the stage, I don't know if you happen to see this.
No.
And then he thanks her, right? And then he refers to her as babe. He calls her babe. And it sends a chill up my spine. My stomach curdles. It epitomizes everything he thinks about himself as a man, as a leader, right, as superior to others, right? And I try to imagine Barack Obama, right, with whom I have real differences, but I try to imagine Barack Obama treating anyone that way, referring to anyone as babe. And that strikes me as so profoundly unlikely, right? If Barack Obama called someone babe like that, we think he had suffered some kind of horrific brain event, but this is the president that we have. This is what he thinks of women. This is what he thinks of people. He called her babe. And I thought that just summed up what was coming.
Well, my dear, thank you so much. I appreciate your help, your thoughts, your wisdom, and I am in solidarity with you every way I can be. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Enjoy our dark, dark day.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
So that was today's inaugural special. We don't do specials very often, but this clearly seemed like one to go with. And we're going to close with some Leon Russell and very, very good advice. And with that, my friends, I leave you and urge you to follow the good advice of Brother Leon Russell and learn how to boogie. Talk to you soon. We'll see you Sunday for our roundtable. This is your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network.